The Vox Markets Podcast. Nothing in this podcast is intended as investment advice, and the people in this podcast may hold positions in the stocks they talk about. Do not buy anything based solely on a tip or recommendation. Please do your own research.
Welcome back, everyone, to Vox Markets. My name is Paul Hill, and by popular demand, I am delighted again to be able to speak to Paul Jordan, CEO of Amati Global, one of the UK's finest investors. So welcome, Paul.
Morning, Paul. Great to be with you again.
Yeah, well, a lot's happened over the past 6 months, not least the sort of the Ukraine-Russia conflict, which actually you were the only fund manager, and I speak to a lot of them, who sort of like said there was a strong possibility that Putin would go in and was massing his troops on the border. So you're spot on there. Now, so like going forward, what does the sort of like the Amati crystal ball say for or predict for sort of equities and any other sort of like potential black swans, I guess?
Yeah, thanks for the. Let's start with the easy question, shall we, Paul?
I never ask easy questions. Apologies.
I mean, it, obviously, inflation is top of everyone's mind at the moment, and actually, you know, a year. If you rewind a year ago, you know, inflation was something we were really worried about, and did kind of see coming. And the reason was quite simple, and I think it's helpful to go over it because, you know, it's. Sometimes the politicians like to blame inflation on the wrong things. I mean, you know, clearly inflation has been made worse by the rise in oil prices and gas prices in particular, and so on and so on, and supply chain problems. But you know, the primary driver of inflation over the past year has been money supply growth, which was just extraordinary in 2020. And you know, we were talking about this year ago is the biggest money supply growth since World War II, since 1947, actually.
We'll allow you 3 days, yeah, 3 years, yeah, off there. That's a pretty good estimate.
It was a kind of wartime money supply growth in the pandemic. And frankly, a lot of it was just pointless and it was over the top. And it said this was central bank policy errors. And, you know, I just think it's important to, if you don't analyze problems right, you can't solve them. And, you know, we need to pin the blame for inflation on those errors so that they don't get made again. And it was as if QE was just the answer to every single problem. And whenever things didn't look quite right, they just, oh, let's just do a bit more QE, and had no kind of sense of exactly how much QE had been done. And, you know, QE makes a lot of sense. I'm not a critic of QE per se. If you keep money supply growth at kind of 5% level, where you then stimulate real GDP growth, and it was working very well. Of course, it had to come to an end, and it, you know, that was always the problem of QE, is how do you get out of it again? But you don't get out of it by suddenly doing four times as much in 1 year as anyone had ever done before, and it just, like, the problem goes away. So it was, you know, it was a real test of monetarist economics, and you know, Milton Friedman's idea that the you know, inflation is always and only a monetary phenomenon, and you know, it's the test, you know, proved the theory, if you like, that if you jack up money supply by that much, you get inflation. So, you know, what will now drive down inflation primarily is going to be the contraction of money supply, and we're seeing that pretty aggressively in the States and in the UK with QT now, quantitative tightening. And in a way, that's more important in some respects than interest rates. And you know, the market's so fixated by interest rates, but you start sucking cash out of the economy and you have the opposite effect. It is disinflationary. So it will treat the problem, whether it's too late, you know, too little, too late, in the sense that you've now got certain very sticky types of inflation embedding themselves in the system. And in particular, of course, wage growth, but all kinds of other things, you know, property rentals and, you know, you name it. It's there's long, sticky types of price rises have appeared, and those are going to be much harder to dampen down again. So, you know, the policy mistake is now was severe, and it's got real and difficult consequences. And it, you know, this is not an easy fix.
So it's putting all that together. What do you say? We're going to get sort of like a. We're going to get a slowdown. We already are. We're getting demand destruction, particularly sort of like, you know, partly actually because of China with their pandemic, zero COVID tolerancy policies. We're seeing sort of commodity prices come off from there, etc.
But putting all this sort of the economics together, are we going to get sort of like a, is it just going to be a soft landing, a slowdown? Are we going to get a mild recession or a severe recession? I know there's nobody knows the answer because it depends on a lot of different things. But what's your sort of gut feel?
Well, I think we will get a recession. I think that the bigger question over it is how long it lasts rather than how deep it is. I think it will be, you know, we should expect it to be quite painful. But, you know, the kind of current consensus thinking about it, and this is what, if you look at the sort of prediction, the market predictions of interest rate movements over the next 10 years suggest that it will be not that long lived, and it will then result in interest rates coming down again. I'm unfortunately not clever enough to know how all that plays out. I think that's a reasonable outlook. But for me, the real issue is how long does it last? And that's a harder question, because obviously that then relates to, well, how quickly does monetary policy bring inflation back down again?
Yeah.
You know, okay, we're just not going to live with this level of inflation, and they'll keep the rates, they'll keep, if you like, suppressing the economy until the inflation subsides.
Well, coming back to another area of your expertise then, in terms of Putin, what's he going to do next? Have you got any feel at all how long that is going to last, and whether we're going to get a CFR, or more sort of like pertinent short term, whether he's going to sort of like turn on or turn off that Nord Stream 1? I mean, any insights there, or is it really just we just got to look at the markets and just see what he does because it's so geopolitically based?
Yeah, I mean...
difficult question, I know. Apologies.
I don't think we should expect any kind of relief from the Putin problem. You know, I unfortunately kind of think the Putin problem only finishes when he dies, whenever that is. And so, you know, he's not going to become a reformed character. He's not going to suddenly become friendly to the West. He is, you know, he clearly is extraordinarily powerful. He's been very calculating, much more calculating, you know, much in a way, much smarter than our politicians have. He's kind of run rings around the West over the last decade, you know, significantly influenced our politics. He's planted a lot of ideas in our sort of body politic, which are very damaging to us. He sort of picked up on a lot of potential ways to kind of sabotage the West, which we were completely blind to. And those have been very effective. And we have woken up some of them, you know, but, you know, not enough. And clearly one of the really important questions for whoever it is who becomes the next prime minister is, how are you going to rid the UK of Russian influence? And it's not been done properly yet, and it needs to be done much more thoroughly. And to do that, we have to actually have some kind of investigation over how big the problem was, which we've never had. That was put off because it was too politically sensitive. You know, we can't afford that kind of luxury anymore. We need to get to the bottom of it and root it out. It's very, very dangerous. And in a sense, other European countries need to do the same thing because it's affected different European countries in different ways. And you know, so, you know, analysing the European energy policy, I was having a conversation with a policymaker from Holland yesterday, and he works on energy policy. And I was saying, well, if you come up with any good energy policy, can you let us have a copy of it? Because we're going to need a better one. And he's saying, oh, no, the UK's got a better one than we have.
Oh, my God.
I'm leading the blind. You know, we've consistently failed on energy policy for quite a long time. And, you know, we've just got to get smarter about these things and better at delivering the difficult things like nuclear power stations. They're doable. They require incredibly good government to bring them about because they're difficult things to, you know, you've got choosing the right technology, choosing the right sites, getting through the permissions, funding and so on. That's, you know, that requires difficult government and it requires, you know, competent, very, very competent government to bring it about. We really need it, those kind of things.
And so putting that together, where are we going to put, where are the best sort of like sectors or areas to put the money? I mean, sort of, I don't want to put words in your mouth here, but sort of gut instinct would be that if it is going through a tough economic period, it's going to be a bit more protracted because we don't really know when Putin's going to, when he's going to die, unfortunately. So with that, on that basis, cyclical areas are going to could probably continue to be challenged for a short period. We've already had a massive sell-off in all things tech and sort of small cap. And a lot of the defensive areas, the healthcare and utilities, are pretty expensive anyway. So, you know, one area that's been really absolutely obliterated is small cap tech secular growth. What's a sort of like top level view for that? Because, you know, I mean, you could say, yes, it's been sold off. But frankly, a lot of bad news is priced in.
Yeah, no, I completely agree with that. You know, it's amazing how very quickly the market adjusts to new mentalities, and you know, keeping up with it, with that adjustment can be difficult, and you don't want to get on the wrong side of it. But a really, really major adjustment has already taken place. So yes, I think there are some pretty compelling opportunities in, you know, not just UK small cap tech, but UK PLC. And particularly with the dollar at 119 or whatever it is today, you know, UK PLC looks very cheap. And, you know, it's interesting, pretty much the only way to make money this year was through corporate takeovers, which is a very sad way of making money because you lose some really great companies. And, you know, fund managers take the bids because they need the cash, frankly. But, you know, and we've had a few bids in our portfolio this year, which has really helped. But on the other hand, I'm very sad to see these companies go. But I think we'll see more of it. And particularly as it becomes a little bit clearer exactly how, you know, where this recession that I'm proposing is coming. And I think most people think it's coming, where that sort of reaches and where it bottoms out. And as soon as there's any kind of visibility over that, I think we'll see corporate activity pick up even more than it has been doing. And then it's the question is then, who are the buyers? And of course, there's a lot of chat about private equity having a lot of money. And, you know, there is huge amount of dry powder in private equity. But there's an issue there as well, in that private equity debt has become massively more expensive than it was. So that's inhibiting some activity there. But on the other hand, corporate buyers have been pretty active. So we might see that actually there's quite a lot of corporate buying that goes on in the next year. It's not great for the stock market. And, you know, I'm a big believer in public markets. I think that, you know, societies like ours really need healthy, strong public markets, because it's how you and I do our savings. And if there aren't great companies to invest in, you know, actually that whole system that we've got just stops working properly. So, you know, we've got to kind of make sure that our capital markets get renewed and refreshed if a lot of really good companies get sold. And you know, that's kind of on the cards possibly for the next year, 2 years. Yeah. And, you know, that of course always happens when market sentiment nosedives as it has been doing. But, you know, it's also a sign that there is pretty good fundamental value in the market. There are companies out there who will recognize that. And, you know, it's interesting where the bids have been. They've been in pretty strong growth companies. And that's not surprising. And you know, those kind of companies haven't been available at these kind of prices for a very long time. So, I think it does make sense to go fishing in that sort of area.
Yeah. Well, I mean, I did notice that the Amati portfolio has got a lot of sort of like high-tech secular growers that have got sort of like, you know, long runways ahead. And I guess if you look at it sort of like from a glasses half full, eventually, you know, the liquidity will improve. In terms of both the trading of the shares, but also more broadly, and you know, the economics will actually improve as well. So if you stick to your best quality businesses, then they will deliver eventually best quality returns. It's just as a matter of what your timeline is and sort of like, you know, patience. Now, just on that one then, on that context, this has been a couple of IPOs, which has been quite interesting. Ensilica, for instance, which does sort of like, as I understand it, customized or tailored chips, basically chip designs for particular applications, and it seems to be about winning some pretty good business, both in sort of a autonomous vehicle, basically EVs and satellite communications and Internet of Things and stuff like that. Do you want to talk us through this one, because this is really quite an interesting strategy in terms of customized sort of chips, because normally it's a one to many model, but this is really a sort of like one to big application model.
Yes, I mean, we're interested in the whole semiconductor area, and the semiconductor industry as a whole is has become very strategic, and the strategic balance, the strategic interests have shifted greatly. So, you know, as a whole, semiconductors are dominated by Taiwan to a ridiculous degree. I mean, when you start to look at the balance of where these things are made, it's crazy how dependent we are on Taiwan. And of course, Taiwan is now at the center of a very difficult
That's the third difficult question I'm going to ask you later on.
So, you know,
you
so
just set yourself up perfectly.
We have to get to the point at some stage. You know, does China invade Taiwan? Of course, I really, really hope not. It's probably the single biggest threat to the whole sort of geopolitical world we live in. Is does Taiwan get invaded by China? And you know, and in some ways, you know, one of the biggest problems about Russia's invasion of Ukraine is that it overturns the post-World War II settlement, whereby, you know, it was made just not worthwhile for one country to invade another, which, you know, pre-World War II, in the sort of colonial system, if you invaded a country, you took it. Everybody thought, well, everyone said, okay, that's yours now. Post-World War II, that changed, and not everybody kind of fully appreciates this. In the post-World War II system, you can go and invade another country, but nobody recognizes it. And it's not treated as yours, hence why Crimea is still disputed. But, you know, actually what Putin's done is he's just kind of thrown that out of the window and said, oh, I don't care about that. I'm just going to go back to kind of pre-World War II behavior. And, you know, so there's a lot of parallels made between today and the 1970s and people saying high inflation and so on and so on. But, you know, actually the more worrying parallels are with the 1930s, where you start to get this very aggressive behavior of certain kind of nationalist, you know, kind of realistically pretty fascist kind of politicians who fuel themselves by this expansionism. And to, you know, that's clearly Putinism. But if President Xi gets reelected, well, gets made president for life in November, and this is a really big moment that's coming up this year, if that happens, and unfortunately most people think it will happen, then, you know, actually this whole question of war with Taiwan becomes really serious, and it's something we do need to pay attention to. But it's why semiconductors have come into everybody's mind, because suddenly we're thinking, well, how on earth do we deal with a situation where, you know, that much of the world's semiconductor capacity potentially goes offline? I mean, it would make what we're living through now with the oil and gas price shocks, you know, pale into, you know,
much significant,
not insignificant, but lesser significance, because this is even more significant. But anyway, so we're pretty interested in the whole realignment of the semiconductor industry. And actually this company Insilico is a rare example of a UK company that is competing on the world semiconductor stage. Of course, it doesn't make semiconductors, but it designs them, and it works in these things called ASICs, which are application specific chips. Mm-hmm. So they are, you know, they're as you were saying, you know, they're not like the kind of things you find in your laptop where you've got a programmable chip that will do everything. The point about ASICs is you design a chip to just do one job, and it does that job with much less power and more efficiency than if it was a chip that could do everything. That's why you have these ASICs. So
right.
You know, every device you use pretty much today will have ASICs in them, because that's the most efficient way of running a device.
Mm.
So you can use programmable chips, but they're always going to be they're going to use more power and so on.
Who do they compete against?
ASIC design will be in all the kind of developed markets. So it's a big kind of global competitive market. But actually, we think actually it's really important for the UK now to put much more emphasis on its own semiconductor industry. Yeah, this question, it's quite relevant, because there's this question over whether we should let the Chinese buy one of the very few remaining manufacturers of semiconductors in the UK. And there's not very many, but there are a couple, and one of them is now being bid for by the Chinese.
Mm.
Should that sale go through? You know, it's kind of, well, if you ask me, you know, definitely not. This now has to be regarded as a strategic industry. And, you know, China, if it were to invade Taiwan, well, after Taiwan, you know, the only two other players of significance in semiconductor manufacturing, one is China, one's Korea. So, you know, Europe is way behind. America is desperately trying to build its own plants now. They're trying to get a Taiwan Semiconductor, the company, to build plants outside of Taiwan. Interestingly, your viewers may not have seen this, but in the States, they passed... They understand this is a highly strategic, important matter. So they passed a bill, they've been working on bills to fund the creation of semiconductor manufacturing in the US. And unfortunately, the two houses in the States have passed different bills. So that so far, they're completely they're rendered completely unworkable because they need to reconcile these two bills. And in Europe, some strategic money has been passed by the European Commission to ensure that some manufacturing gets built. As it turns out, it's going to be built in Germany. It's a couple of new plants being built there. You know, it's one thing that Europe's, I think, has picked up on. You know, the UK badly needs to pick up on this because now we're not part of Europe anymore. You know, there's a big danger of just being completely left out of the really important strategic things that like this that go on. So we, you know, it's an area of really interesting focus for us. Yeah. And Antelico, if you like, it's Antonio's. Obviously, it's a small little company. ASIC, you know, they've been winning business in ASIC design. It's an area that I think is strategically important for the UK, and you know, we think Antelico has got a good shot of you know, becoming a significant player in that area for in the UK context.
Yeah. So yeah, we've got obviously then we've got chip or silicon chip sort of like security and bringing it onshoring. We've obviously got the all things electrification, given the you know, Ukraine Russia war, etc., trying to get off the dependency of Russian oil and gas. Now another one you've invested in, which is a bit earlier, which is strip tinning, which basically does sort of like connectors, but it's sort of for our cars and automotives, but it's focusing more on EVs, where it's connectors for glazing and for other sort of like, you know, I think it's broad brush sort of connecting systems are going to be hugely required into EVs. And it just recently won a pretty good order, I think, with BMW actually, which is a huge endorsement of the technology.
Yes, I mean, so this is an investment from our VCT where, you know, the VCT by its very nature is backing companies very early on, as was in Silica, of course. So you know, these are classic VCT type investments for us, where we're identifying what we think are pretty important UK companies and using the tax privileges of the VCT to really support them and really help them get where they need to go. And you know, strip tinning is another one where we think it, you know, this the UK has a really strong automotive industry. Sometimes surprises people to know that. Obviously, there are a lot of challenges to it from Brexit, but there's you know, significant parts of it can still really thrive. And you know, strip tinning is just a good example. And you're right; it's got a core legacy, if you like, a legacy business, which you know, has been there for a long time and has that the benefit of maturity. But it's not going to be high growth. But then the new part addressing the EV market and the you know, the many new vehicle designs that are going to be coming along and new requirements that electric vehicles bring, because they don't have a combustion engine to drive the electricity generation. So you've got to be very careful how you use electricity, and ironically in electric vehicles, you've got to be more prudent about how you use it within the car. Yeah, we think strip tinning, you know, it's got an important role to play. Unfortunately, the shares, if you look at them, have been hit pretty hard since the IPO. And that's really because the big automotive OEMs, as you and your viewers will well know, have been really struggling to make vehicles. And the primary, you know, the biggest single reason for that is they can't get hold of the chips. And that goes back to this whole chip problem we were talking about a few minutes ago.
Yeah, you know, you're definitely putting your money in some smart places there. And I would point investors as sort of like I say, it IPO'd, I think, February, 185p strip tinning. It's roughly around 105, so you can get it at about a sort of 30-40% discount. Another one which is sort of like recently IPO'd is Zenova, which does really sort of like interesting paint and insulation materials, and has got a patent pending fire extinguisher that will save me a shed load of money. It means that you can then basically have a fire extinguisher which does both electrical and normal flame, puts them out, extinguishes normal flame fires. So really quite interesting, actually, because it could upturn that whole industry.
I absolutely. I mean, Zenova is a kind of below the radar company still really at the moment, because
I've never heard of it.
Yeah, no, and in a way, it floated, possibly a bit prematurely, in the sense of it's kind of like a startup, But what's not like a startup is the products themselves have been designed over many years, and they're really, really interesting and, you know, potentially very, very important products. And it's not just the fire extinguisher, which, for people who haven't seen it, you know, it just has this property of taking the heat out of fire. So it's quite extraordinary when you see it in action. And you're right, you could have one fire extinguisher in your office or your house or wherever you're building, which will tackle any kind of fire. And that's, but not just give you equivalence, but actually be much more effective than any other fire extinguisher, because it removes the heat out of the flames. But they've also got some other products that really interest me. So a couple of them are insulating products. And one of them is an insulating paint, which you can paint onto the inside of a building, onto the walls. And so it's a very thin, you know, it gives you just like 10, 15 microns coat. So it's quite a thick coat of paint, but it's still just a coat of paint. And that, you know, supposedly gives you some pretty remarkable insulating properties, but they've also put that same thing into a render that you can put onto the outside of a wall. And, you know, given how massively important insulation is, you know, now sits within with our mindset, you know, we badly, badly need to insulate our properties in Britain much more effectively than we have been doing. You know, these two products from Zenova look really interesting to me. So the question is then, you know, proving them up. And to do that, you've got to stimulate the demand. You've got to get them out there in the market, get them used enough so you can really address all the use cases properly for them. And so, you know, Zenova is in that mode where it's proving its products up, it's stimulating the demand, it's probably talking to hundreds of different potential buyers of these things. They all are quite so moving. But, you know, it's got this suite of products which are, if all the claims they make for them stack up, then they're exceptionally interesting. But, you know, there's another one which is like a fire break product for forest fires. And again, which is using the same idea as their a fire extinguisher, but in a spray that you can spray over vegetation and create breaks. And again, with these kind of super heat waves, we're seeing that product just looks really important. So, you know, they've got this suite of products they've designed over many years, and they're bringing them to market at a time when you would have thought this couldn't be, it couldn't really have a more receptive kind of audience.
Yeah, I'd highlight to investors. I mean, it's only a 15 million market cap business.
And it's early days, you know. It's sales were starting from, yeah.
But just less than about 4 million. Sales are about 4 million. But they're hoping to get to sort of like a profitable cash generative by the end of next year, I think it is. And I think you're exactly right. I mean, not only has it got the fire extinguisher, but if it does insulation and fire retardants for buildings, one, it's got the Grenfell in terms of, you know, sort of like improving fire resistance for blocks of flats and stuff. But equally, with the extreme temperatures we're getting in the summer, when it gets too hot with insulation, it's going to stop the heat coming in. And so if you keep it cool, and in the winter, obviously, it's going to reduce your electricity bill, which is the cost of living crisis, full stop, isn't it? So stick a coat of this thing on, and then it reduces your bill by 20%, which is an incentive enough for me. Just moving on to a medical one, which is quite interesting, which has got sold off. And I know Christopher Mills has been buying recently Verici, which is a spin out from I think it was originally EKF and Renalytics, etc. And it came out with some pretty good diagnostics data for one of its lead products, Tutiva, 60% positive predictive value. But Christopher mentioned it was about three. It was a multiple more than their in the nearest events. And the shares went down. It just seems as though the market hasn't understood this one at all.
Yeah, I mean, it's early days. And I think, you know, Verici is suffering from a sector-wide issue that, you know, that when markets go through what they are, you know, people shun sort of, you know, futuristic kind of companies where the cash flows are quite a long way off, and you've got to fund a lot of losses to get there, and that's really Verici's issue. It's just early, and the market's not in favor of early stage companies right now. Hopefully that doesn't last forever, but, you know, that doesn't turn around first. You know, the first things that will turn around and go back up will be the sort of, you know, the kind of things we were talking about earlier, the profitable growth companies. You know, the more forward-looking kind of propositions come after that. So yeah, I mean, it's got some important tests for each, absolutely for sure. And it's a small position in our VCT, but it's also, you know, we've got quite a long way to go with it still.
Yeah. Albeit it could be a takeover target for something like CareDx because yeah. The market cap of what is it now? Oh, it's about $35 million. I mean, yeah. You know, it's a drop in the ocean compared to CareDx, particularly when it's the biggest challenge, I think, to their science. Yes. Now, another sort of fallen angel that's that looks very tasty, to apologies for the pun, is the UK's number one sort of like delicious, well, affordable fresh cream cakes, Cake Box. Now, its shares has just gone up and down. It was topped £4 about 12 months ago, had a few sort of like minor, really, accountancy things between for its year end. The shares sold off hard, went down to about £1.50. I did see a couple of interested fund managers buying in, like Richard Penny at Crux Asset Management, and now they're back to £2. And they put out some pretty blockbuster results. What's your sort of view on this one? Because it's cashed up and people still want to buy, celebrate a cake, and it's pretty cheap to buy a cake.
Yeah, look, it's a good company, and it's a strong proposition. It just needed to, you know, it had made that transition of being a kind of company run by a few friends and, you know, kind of almost like a family business to being a quoted company, you know, without quite going through the real kind of rigors of improving its kind of operating structures and so on, and its internal disciplines enough. And they got caught out in a few things, which they shouldn't have got caught out over. And, you know, they changed the CFO. That must have been quite painful because I'm sure he's a good friend of the chief executive. Yeah. But, you know, they've had to kind of really strengthen the internal controls. And that's what is required with Cake Box. It had to do that. And now the market probably can sort of check it's for real. And if it is, then, you know, yeah, I think hopefully it can move on from that. That's that series of, you know, just unfortunate things that came to light. As you say, none of them were massively significant. It's not as if they were cooking the books or anything. There was no suggestion of deceit in any way. This was just not good enough control, you know, poor controls, things that shouldn't have happened, and mistakes that were made that shouldn't have really got through. And with better internal controls, that hopefully won't happen again.
Yeah, I mean, that sounds to me, it's one of those, you know, temporary issues that, you know, you've had an artificial sell-off, and they're resolvable because it's self. It's just do it yourself. A bit more investment, etc. So, you know, they're not. It isn't a secular issue. It's more of a sort of like a short-term, temporary hiccup.
No, I think that's right. And you know, but clearly, I think one reason why the shares haven't just bounced straight back is because now we've got the issue of, well, how do they get affected by the recession? And that's just an unknown quantity. You know, if they can prove the model holds up even when consumers are much shorter of cash, then, you know, amazing. I think that would be, it'd be wrong to just assume that they don't get affected at all. So The question is, how much do they get affected, and what's the timing of that? How resilient can they be in the face of a consumer recession? And that's what they've got to prove next.
Yeah. Well, my family are going to carry on buying a Cake Box. Cakes and products, that's for sure. My wife's really looking forward to the lemon version as well. Now, moving on to sort of like other real sort of strong secular growth, which is benefiting really from the Ukraine-Russia conflict is cybersecurity. And you've got one NCC in the portfolio, which is quite interesting. And I know Andy Brough of Schroders quite likes this one, and it's sort of split into two parts. I think it's got an advisory consulting arm that generates the sort of the mainstay of the actual profits. And then it's got quite an interesting escrow business that allows its corporate customers to put software into a big secure vault, such that if you get ransomware or attacks, then you can always get your software back, i.e. the NHS needed that a few years ago.
Yes, and the escrow actually is primarily about if you're paying for some software to be developed and your software developer goes bust, what happens to the software? It means that that's one use case. I mean, there are other use cases too. Mm. Yeah, if your software developer got hacked, I suppose, but it's more about is more about the security over ownership, that, you know, you paid for it and the software developer can't just sort of, if they disappear, you've still got the software, in other words.
Right,
and
okay.
So it's a sort of quasi-insurance type business. It's that, you know, that's the stable part of NCC's revenues.
It makes good, makes 70% gross margins on that one, doesn't it?
It's a very strong niche business, but it doesn't grow that fast.
Mm.
Whereas the other side of it, you know, can grow much faster, but it's been a bit more difficult than one might have thought. And I guess the issue over the other side of it is, and this actually relates to kind of bigger discussion with more general interest in the way that is pricing power, and, you know, how does pricing power flow through a recession? And actually, you can make predictions over which companies you think have got it and which haven't. And actually, you'd be doing very well if you got those predictions right, because sometimes you get just caught out by companies who don't have as much pricing power as you thought. And so that's been one area of sort of like debate over NCC's consulting businesses, how much pricing power they had. But what we know they've had is cost inflation. And every IT business has got huge cost inflation at the moment because there's a skills shortage in technical IT skills. And companies have been, and particularly the big American tech companies, have been hoovering up every kind of able individual at vastly increased salaries, and that's pushed up costs. And so, you know, one thing that held NCC back last year was that the cost inflation couldn't keep up with their pricing. So this year it's all about the pricing, and I think they will move the pricing up to reflect that. So it's an interesting company. I think it put it, those are its issues, and those are things you have to sort of look out for. But they're also kind of wider questions for looking at every company, is, you know, asking what's its pricing power, what's its, you know, how much are its costs going up, and how do those two things relate together?
I wouldn't be surprised if somebody like Accenture decided to have a shot at this one, because it, you know, to bolster their
100%. I mean, yeah. You know, NCC at a low rating, it's a classic target. You're right.
Yeah, another one is it's just sort of like headed up by a very colourful advertising guru, and actually sort of like he's an economics guru. Is Sir Martin Sorrell's S4 Capital, which is all sort of like digital advertising, and they got sort of like earlier in the year embroiled in sort of like delayed sort of release of their audited results. The shares sold off hard, and then you've had this the concern over sort of a potential recession, how it's going to impact digital advertising, which is their specialism, and they're sort of like an agency. But the shares have actually even still have sort of fallen quite hard, and they trade on roughly around about, just looking at it, sort of like eight and a half times EBITDA, which for sort of like they're hoping to grow at 25% or something like that this year. Certainly double digits anyway, faster than the digital advertising market.
Yeah, and you know, the market went from being completely in love with the stock to now being very skeptical about it. And, you know, it's got to prove that, again, it's a company that didn't have adequate internal controls, and they came out with that and said that. So now they put those in place. They're expensive. It's got to kind of prove itself, really. And I'd say that the jury's out, really, until they do that.
Yeah. I guess the big question is really sort of how much of that business is cyclical growth, which is digital advertising, versus how much is sort of cyclical in terms of, you know, if we go through a recession, how much the advertising market's going to drop off. We saw a bit of it, didn't we, with Google and with Facebook with the pandemic, but I don't know if you've got a feel on that one at all. I guess we'll find out in due course.
Yes, and I don't know the answer to that. And that, in a way, that's what the market's kind of waiting to see with S4, I think.
Okay, now a couple of small ones which are counter-cyclical plays are Begbies Traynor and FRP Advisory, which seem perfectly placed for the increase in the sort of like level of restructuring and insolvencies. As we've come out of the pandemic, the government's lifted its creditor protection measures. There's a big sort of backlog. We're getting into harder recessionary conditions. Liquidity is drying up and bank is tightening its credit. And we've already seen that coming through the insolvency stats from the government. Do you want to take us through both of these? Because, I mean, it does seem as though both businesses are pretty well placed as a sort of counter-cyclical play.
Yeah, and that's why we own them both, really. I think in the portfolio, you always want some things which can flourish when other things aren't, you know, finding it really tough. And those two companies built up the holdings over the last couple of years, really, because you know, we do think that actually in a recessionary kind of environment, their business should really, you know, the insolvency side of the business will, and the administrations will you know, expand really rapidly. You know, there's been a bit of a desert of administrations in particular and insolvencies through the pandemic, because of course businesses were protected hugely, and the safety measures which, you know, kept a lot of businesses in place that we needed to survive also kept a load of businesses in place that probably shouldn't have survived, really. And it was a pretty indiscriminate. So there's quite a lot of catch up to do in any case. I think they're both going to be very busy over the next couple of years.
And they're both sort of buy and build, and they're both cashed up actually as well. I did see Begbies have got sort of £4.7 million net cash on their balance sheet, and yeah. FRP has even got even more. It's got about 18 million of or forecast of about 18 million of net cash. So
yeah, they're prudently run. Yeah, and you know, Begbies has been diversifying its business, so it's not just about insolvency and administration. It has a lot of other consultancy type businesses, which is smart, because you know, if your only business is administrations and insolvency, you know, you can be very feast and famine. And I think we're about to go into a bit more of a feast type environment for them. You know, it's smart to be to have more strings to your bow.
Another one on the sort of like the EV side or all things is, I know we've talked about, is Saeta. And it sort of come off quite a lot in terms of, it's about 135 now, 140, et cetera. But it had an operational update saying it was seeing good sort of like pipeline progression in terms of its sort of like delivery van, sort of like, you know, axial flux motors to that sector. Plus they're putting in this integrated systems approach, which is now possible because they bought that, as you mentioned last time, they bought that e-traction, and now they've obviously got that lease in the Sunderland facility, and they've obviously got the motorboats and stuff like that. But this looks like, again, another baby in the bathwater that's been thrown out, very well positioned, and just probably need to land a few big OEM deals.
Yeah, I mean, talking about the UK automotive sector, and, you know, I think Saeta should turn out to be one of the real gems of the UK automotive market. And it's, you know, they've made some incredible progress really over the last year with that acquisition. And the Sunderland plant is not just a lease on a huge factory. It's, you know, it's got a lot of equipment there that was for making electric motors, albeit different types of electric motors from Saeta's. But they can repurpose that. And if they can repurpose it, then, you know, it's potentially like £40 million worth of equipment. They paid £1.5 million for it because it was of no use to anyone else. If they can turn that into really productive equipment, it will show what a extraordinary deal that was for them. But of course, you know, yes, what the market's waiting for is a bit more visibility over how they really get into this position where they're producing, you know, maybe like 100,000 motors a year, and it starts to generate cash and so on and so on. And you know, when you speak to Vic, who runs it, you know, he's just so excited about their opportunity. You know, that's incredibly infectious. And it's all about, you know, coming up with the path for the resources he's got available. And you know, clearly he'd like to conquer the whole world with what they've got. But
he's done a pretty good job, hasn't he?
He's doing a pretty good job. But you know, I think it's exciting. The sell-off in the shares is just reflecting the kind of, you know, the lack of risk appetite in the market, of course. But yeah, I think that's a pretty special company, and one that, you know, if it can make the right moves and, it's got a huge opportunity, and it's just a question of how they decide to kind of slice and dice that and what the order of events is going to be.
Yeah. And I think Canaccord, the housebroker's got a £2.75 per share price target on it compared to £1.35. So plenty of, I mean, almost, well, double upside. So another one, which is it's sort of an interesting medical one, is Intelligent Ultrasound, that is basically all things to, ultrasound machines, sort of is classroom to clinic. They provide the simulators to help people, to train people, but also they're sort of retrofitting and also putting into new models and AI sort of imaging analysis bit of software that I think they have a good deal with GE Healthcare that is helping them basically that's well their first major sort of OEM that they've got. They seem to have some quite good niche technology that should benefit presumably from the return of elective procedures.
Yes, I think that's absolutely right. Yeah, I mean it's a company that has you know been meeting its targets. It's been performing to its business plan. It's got an interesting opportunity. The relationship with GE is very strong. The idea behind it we think is strong. So yes, it's sort of just continuing to deliver what one would expect of it, it still has exactly the opportunity we thought it did.
Yeah.
Yes, it's proving itself.
Good. One which is a sort of slight fallen angel is Science in Sport, that given it's the Tour de France, I think you've got the Ineos Grenadiers and the rest of the team sort of consuming vast amounts of these gels, which could provide Science in Sport. So it's great advertising, but they had a trading update, a month ago or something like that, or just recently, which said that they were seeing rising costs and they had a sort of slowdown in demand, etc., which seems sort of slightly odd. Anyway, the shares have been absolutely, like everybody else, has been totally hammered, and again look interesting for a sort of like a really vertically integrated strong niche brand, performance brand for food. What's your sort of latest view on Science in Sport?
We're actually one of the teams going to go and visit them next week, so we'll have a better view coming up.
On his bike, with his gels.
he should be cycling there.
Yeah, exactly.
It's been a long wait with Science in Sport. You know, it's required a lot of patience from investors. I think it's one where hopefully it can get to some kind of critical mass. It still needs to break through into profitability. So clearly it's frustrating that they have these issues over costs going up. And their costs exceeded budget by quite some margin, which was frustrating, it's hopefully got what it takes to get where it needs to. I mean, probably the end game for it, maybe to find a buyer for the business. I don't know, but
yeah, I was going to say, that was an M&A.
That's always been the plan at the back of, investors' minds, because it hasn't happened, and it's just proven a long wait. But the business is getting bigger and stronger, which is what we need to see happening. And the sales, it's about getting to critical mass, and that's a long journey. But if they can get there, then hopefully there's better news ahead for the investors.
Yeah, you'd have thought somebody, one of the big over-the-counter or sort of like performance food businesses. I mean, Haleon, which is just listed, might be interested in it. Unilever, yeah. P&G, anybody like Nestle, I don't know.
If you succeed in that market, you get bought, so that's... But they still need to kind of take a couple more steps forward and start generating the
cash. Well, it happened to Ben and Jerry's, didn't it? Albeit that's not a performance food. It's more of a sort of like
that shows you how big you have to be. I mean, they were huge, of course. It feels like it needs to kick on a bit more.
Yeah. What about G-Tech that, again, is sort of moved into sort of hydrogen? It's had for some time. It's been on the market. I think it's Jonathan... Copa, I can't remember. But anyway, he's been running it for some time. They've got a sort of specialism in geospatial sort of like data, and they've put a software layer on it that is focused largely historically on mining and in oil and gas exploration. But now they're sort of moving into carbon capture and, more importantly, into the whole hydrogen ecosystem, putting up hydrogen hubs around the UK, which is quite an interesting sort of diversification.
Yeah, it is an interesting diversification, and they make quite a compelling case for hydrogen hubs. My own view on hydrogen is it's way more difficult than most people who talk about it realize. This is a very, very difficult part of the energy transition, if it's even a part of it at all. And they obviously make another case that there is. But if you are going to run commercial vehicles or trains from hydrogen, you need to refuel them at a hub. You can't have lots and lots of hydrogen refilling stations all over the place. That's never going to work. So the idea of building some hubs are absolutely the sort of central point where you've got a lot of vehicles coming to refuel. That does make sense. And, you know, quite sensibly, GTEC put itself into the mix as a developer of those and formed an interesting relationship with SGN, who a lot of the infrastructure, the gas network, the old gas network, and these old low pressure gas storage facilities, you know, which may have a role to play in hydrogen. One of the big issues about hydrogen is about pressure, and you know the real problem with hydrogen is it's just not very energy dense, and that this is not, you know, often not.
I didn't know that. That's interesting. Yeah.
I don't know if you watch those Earthshot programs at the beginning, at the end of, you know, the Duke of Cambridge was presenting, and when he was talking about hydrogen, he unfortunately made the classic mistake of saying, well, if you take a kilogram of hydrogen and a kilogram of jet fuel, the hydrogen has three times more energy, which is true, but the problem is that 1 kilogram of hydrogen at room temperature takes up something like 1,100 litres.
Right.
Whereas 1 kilogram of jet fuel is about 1.5 litres.
Yeah. Okay.
So if you're going to get that much hydrogen in the same space, you've got to squash it down to an unbelievable degree. Of course, that requires a lot of energy. But also, there's another problem that when you squash it down like that, it will attack most of its containers pretty effectively. So
corrosive.
Metal gets embrittled by it. And it's because that particularly when it's under a lot of pressure, the neutrons from hydrogen are just smashing into the metal so fast that it tends to destroy metals pretty quickly. So it's only a certain set of containers that can hold it. And you know, that's why I don't think you can just sort of pressurize the gas high pressure network and stick hydrogen into it, because you've got to prove that it won't embrittle the metals that contain it. And there's a lot of work going on over that, but it's why there's this big kind of hiatus over hydrogen development, is because it's difficult. And you know, the politicians assume, oh, we can just use hydrogen, that's the answer to everything, forgetting the fact that, you know, hydrogen is not an energy source at all. There's no natural hydrogen you can just go and grab and say, oh, that's our energy. So all it ever is a battery.
Mm.
And the question then is it a very good battery? You know, I remain to be properly convinced, but you know, if there is a case for having these kind of hydrogen hubs around the UK, and there may be, then GTEC's very well placed for that. But you know, they're also expanding the range of their existing businesses. And one of the other interesting things they've started working on is actually geothermal. I think geothermal could become more widespread and start to become of a lot more interest than it has been.
Heat pumps.
Yeah.
Okay. Well, it's fascinating. I didn't realize that. So that's terrific. Now, a couple of sort of secular growers that one, again, I tip my hat is Equals, because we've talked about it a couple of times. You're this sort of 4XE payments firm that you guys own. I mean, they're like for like growth in the last trading update in the first half of 80%. So they're knocking the ball out of the park, and the shares, given the backdrop, are actually doing pretty well.
Again, that's been a long journey with Equals. It's had to really pivot away from being a consumer-facing business with Fairfax. I've still got a Fairfax card from the old days. You know, I don't know whether you have too.
Yeah.
But you know, they really got pushed out of that market by Revolut and Monzo and you know all the other new entrants that came in with effectively free foreign exchange. So you know, you really shouldn't be paying for your foreign exchange very much when you go abroad now, which you know is an incredible benefit that the financial system's delivered, but they've pivoted pretty effectively to more to kind of B2B type model, and there are lots of interesting opportunities which they're picking up on.
Well done on that one. Now, Tiny Build, which is gaming developer. Again, it's sort of like did very well, obviously, in the pandemic. And the only sort of question, I mean, is, you know, when we, as we come out of the pandemic, how's gaming going to hold up, I guess?
Yes. I mean, that's interesting. Of course, there was a big boost to gaming revenues in the pandemic.
Mm.
I think that's now pretty well established. And, you know, overall, the revenues in the gaming industry, you know, have come under pressure, not surprisingly. consumer recession, plus you got the pandemic kind of boost. But there is still secular growth in that industry, albeit, you know, we're probably going to see now a year of more difficult trading conditions. And then, you know, hopefully the secular growth continues to come through. Within that context, actually, Tinybill's been performing really well. And, their sales have been delivering. They're a very effective management team. The acquisitions they made have been good. And the new game releases, which the new iterations of the games that they have, you know, there's a big one about to come out, actually, which, you know, on which quite a lot will hinge. But, you know, they, it looks like they're doing that pretty effectively.
Mm. Yeah, well, again, I mean, I think gaming has had some huge sort of like tailwinds to the pandemic, but there is still a secular growth, particularly as we move into all things, virtual, isn't it? The metaverse and stuff like that, because it's going to be pretty key there. Now, sort of an old sort of like industry, again, a couple of interesting ones is Belvoir, which is basically a franchised estate agent in the UK that has sort of heavily really dependent on rentals. Also, obviously, some sales of houses, but has also got a mortgage type of financial services business associated with it. And the shares have sold off like all things real estate in the UK. But actually, the company is still doing pretty well. It's only on 11 times PE ratio.
Yeah. I mean, it's been that one and the property franchise group are quite similar businesses. Mm. And, you know, there have been lots of investors have asked whether those two companies should get together, and that there probably is a good logic for it. You've got to get a management fit and there's a solution to that. But, you know, they're primarily actually letting agencies more than estate agents.
Yeah.
But Belvoir diversified into estate agency a few years ago and actually did it at a pretty good time. Mm. But estate agency is obviously a more cyclical area. And, you know, it's one of the kind of very curious things about the situation we're in at the moment where, you know, we're talking about recessions and so on, but actually some parts of the economy, you'd never ever know that was even remotely on the cards. And the housing market is one of them. You know, you try and buy a house today and you're not going to think there's a recession on anything but, because you're just lucky if you can find one. Mm. And I suppose that reflects the fact that there's still a very large accumulation of savings from the pandemic. And so this is not a normal kind of recessionary environment at all. So some parts of the economy that are cyclical are performing very strongly, and the housing market is one of them still.
Yeah. Another one is Brooks McDonald, which is basically a fund manager. And I think, they've obviously, like everybody, all the other fund managers, the actual portfolio value has decreased because they've had a sell-off in stocks and bonds across the market. But they're still getting sort of inflows. And again, the shares are sort of like, you know, come off quite a lot. Interesting, you know, just an interesting wealth manager, given there's lots and lots of M&A going on in that area with many companies buying people out. It's on a sort of like, it's got plenty of cash and it's on a 13 times PER.
Yeah, I mean, that's just reflecting the wider sector selling off. And that, you know, actually, I think it's those companies are all pretty attractive in you know, not all, but I mean, they're in general, the many wealth managers that, the market doesn't give them really a lot of credit for how resilient those businesses are. Mm. Very strong, they're very strong business franchises. So, like that area.
Yeah. Well, I think, I mean, 350 million market cap, somebody's going to have a pop at that one, maybe, given the amount of consolidation, because it's a big sort of like. But now, really, just to finish on a couple of small micro caps is Fusion Antibodies and Rosslyn Data says, now Fusion Antibodies is like a CRO, isn't it? Which does sort of like services for antibodies for drug discovery, but preclinical. Well,
yeah, it's not exactly a CRO. So CROs typically would run clinical trials for pharmaceuticals.
Oh, okay, sorry, wrong words.
But yeah, it's a service provider to pharma companies. And what they specialize in is humanizing antibodies. And you know, I'll talk about this like I understand it, but of course I'm not a scientist. So
you're pretty good.
But we do have a scientist in the team, luckily. But so a lot of antibodies, of course, you know, was a massively expanding area of medicine, of targeting pathogens with antibodies that can lock onto them and then using that to deliver medicines that can kill them. A lot of the research that was done on antibodies would derive the original antibodies from mice and or from other animals. A lot of them would come from mice or other things. And then, but then when you find the antibody you want to use, if that's how you found the original, you've then got to humanize it to be able to put it into humans. And that's the kind of work that fusion antibody really specialize in. And, they've been, I think, really pushing the envelope with this and making some big strides in what they're able to do, how quickly they can do it, how many candidates they can get. And, they had a business plan when they floated, which had involved a number of steps of, if you like, making this all more efficient and faster and better results. And this is to do with actually just selecting the antibodies to start with and be able to then humanize them more effectively. It's like a lot of reasonably early stage businesses. It's a long journey. And, their CEO left, they hired another really good CEO, but they got poached by another company, offered them much more money.
Right, okay.
So now they've got to find somebody else. There's an interesting business developing away underneath there. But like all these things, it takes time. But we think they've got some very good capabilities.
Mm.
And
the market cap's only 12 million. So, but they do have some cash on the balance sheet. So, and they are approaching EBITDA break even actually in a huge total addressable market.
And they've had reasonably good sales progression. They've got good lab facilities. Interestingly, because Northern Ireland comes up now a bit in political debate, there aren't many companies in Northern Ireland on the stock market. And in particular, there aren't many that have been supported by VCTs. I think there's only three, and we've supported two of the companies in Northern Ireland that have any, I think any VCTs have supported. The other one is...
Diaceutics,
yeah, exactly. They're really interesting companies that have emerged in Northern Ireland, and from that point of view, they're quite important.
It seems to be a good hotbed actually, Northern Ireland, for all things medicine and tech. Actually, I think it's because of I don't know why, but it's people like to rock up there and do some really good science.
Yeah, well, they've got some good pharma skills, some good scientific skills.
So. No, it's great. Keep it going, boys. So just finalising on Rosslyn data. I know they're going through. They put out a trading update just recently, and they're sort of like looking to unbundle some of their businesses. I think it's the old unstructured data integrity business they're looking to sell, but also their Langdon customs exercise business, having just done a huge big product refresh on their big data supply chain sort of procurement, master procurement data platform, Rapid, or they've called it Rosslyn now, I think. There's a lot of moving parts. The shares have been sold off, etc. What's your latest view? Is it sort of just a wait and see, is it? Or show me story? Or?
It's an interesting situation. And, I think the issue with Rosslyn is that it had interesting data analytics at a time when data analytics was, the place to be really in software. But it never really kind of had the management who could build a software company that really looked like it was going somewhere. So the sales progression just never happened.
Yeah.
And so the original CEO got replaced by somebody who was, a very safe pair of hands and competent guy and somebody I liked, but probably not really a kind of software CEO.
Yeah.
And so now what the board did is they brought in somebody who really does come from a software CEO type background. He said he's kind of taken a whole new look at the data analytics software and said, we can do much more with this than we've been doing, but we've really got to become much more responsive to customer demands. And we got to have a more agile development suite that brings on board the customers who want to use this.
It's Paul Watts, isn't it?
Yeah. So really the company's throwing everything at this, and I don't want to say it's a bit of a gamble, but it's got to deliver on this strategy. And clearly probably some of the people who've been there a long time are thinking, oh, well, this isn't very good. It's just kind of throwing the baby, too much change. He's not recognized what we, but if this new strategy delivers and it becomes, actually a software growth company, it gets to a much more interesting place that was just never reaching before. And it was always where it needed to get to. So, I kind of think it probably had to go down this road and bring in a new CEO and you know, actually really look at this core business and say, what's not been working about it? How do we get this to become, to reach its potential? And if it can reach the potential of that software, you know, that's much bigger than it's ever been before. You know, if it can't, then that's going to be, it's going to be painful. Yeah. So we're kind of, I think what we need to do is look out for the results from that. And if they start to appear, then, you know, we start to become convinced, yeah, this is now a product, a proposition that customers are really going to go for. And we'll initially you get this kind of drop where, you know, they refresh this product completely. Yeah. So, you know, they're in a bit of this period where you just now got to look for this. Do they get the big uptick or not? And that's going to become apparent in the next 6 months, a year.
Well, I think investors are looking to you and Gresham House to make sure that they hold their feet, the management teams hold their feet to the fire and refine their strategy to make sure they sell, I guess, is the sort of the key mantra. Now, just sort of coming full circle then, sort of like this in the small cap area or, you know, mid small cap area, have we reached a sort of like, what's your sort of view? I mean, have we're reaching a bottom, or do you think this is sort of like a, we're still sort of like some way to go? I mean, just as a top level?
Well, I think the market has done a lot of the repricing that it was going to do and reassessing and saying, okay, we've got recession, we've got higher interest rates, these things are painful. We've also got a war. We've got other big geopolitical threats. You know, I don't think it's ever possible to call a bottom. And I think I would just say one thing about this particular crisis we're in, or this particular downturn we're in, is that, you know, the last few downturns we've had, probably as long as most of us can remember, have been quite short-lived. And we're used to kind of, you know, things then happening pretty quickly and everything gets patched up and on we go. You know, I think this one might take a bit longer. And you know, so I don't think that it's never right to panic in markets. And all you can do as investors find the best businesses you can buy, and you stick with them because they're going to get you where you want to go in the end. But I think it'd be wrong to just get too aggressively bullish right now, because the wavelength, if you like, of this problem, of this situation we're in, is probably a bit longer than we're used to. So
I love that, the wavelength. Fabulous. That takes me back to physics.
So I think it's right to be, you know, a bit cautious how we deal with this market, and not just assume that there's a massively quick fixes and we'll go back to the races. This is, you know, but let's stick with the good companies, because there's lots of reasons to be optimistic about them.
Yeah, well, that's really wise words to conclude, Paul. So I really appreciate all your insights and inputs and comments on the companies. Fascinating. And I've certainly learned a lot about hydrogen and all the sciences and medicals and antibodies and stuff. So I'm sure investors are greatly appreciated. So big, big thanks from everybody for your time, and look forward in touching base in 6 months.
Great pleasure. Thanks very much, Paul. Great to be with you, as always.
The Vox Markets Podcast. Nothing in this podcast is intended as investment advice, and the people in this podcast may hold positions in the stocks they talk about. Do not buy anything based solely on a tip or recommendation. Please do your own research.